This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2015. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast, we listen to a few poems in the current issue. This month, we're going to hear poems from Thomas Lux.
And Freddie said, also, the feds.
Karen Solis.
The seaside visits you, rudely.
And Frank Bidart.
Jamukha pulled a blanket over himself and Temujin.
We're joined by Christina Pugh, the consulting editor for Poetry Magazine. She's here to talk with us about the poems this month. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Don and Lindsay.
Hi. Let's start with the poem by Thomas Lux, which is called The Horse Poisoner.
No one knew why horses were dying. Two from two farms over, one in town, three at the poor farm, not in great shape anyway, so no concern at first. Then the mayor's son's pony, then three stalls in a row at the local sulky track. The vet sent blood to the state police, who sent it to Boston for further analysis. Meanwhile, two more died. One so old it was no surprise, and another mistaken for a deer and shot. Some people wanted to make a connection, but the errant hunter was cousin to the sheriff and was known as too dim to pull off a string of horse poisonings. There were no more suspicious deaths in the county for 2 months. Then, three lying down next to each other, seen first by my cousin Freddie at dawn in the town square. He delivered newspapers. Horses rarely lie down flat unless they're sick or dead. Test results came back from Boston and, Freddie said, also the feds. Inconclusive, though each necropsy showed that the poison was delivered with the aid of a carrot or a sugar cube in a carrot.
I love a poem that tells a story.
It's funny when you read it on the page, but it's much funnier when you hear him read it. He has this sort of almost newscaster tone about it.
Storyteller. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And it would seem kind of strangely objective until you get to the part about his cousin Freddie, and then you know that this is a real person relaying the story to you as opposed to some sort of anonymous voice.
Yeah, I think that's a great moment there when my cousin Freddie is introduced. It does give it more that storyteller kind of flavor. I think you're right.
Well, but it's also really the kind of story that you can only tell in a poem. There's a kind of a nod here, I suppose, to poets like James Wright or Robert Bly. I mean, there's something about these horses. There's so many poems that talk about horses. But this poem is sort of, I think, about this lyrical notion we have that horses do, as they used to say, a certain kind of work in the poem. And what I like is that this kind of buries, no pun intended, that lyricism, even though it's very straight-faced for the most part. At the end of the poem, it's so mysterious again. So it's not just sending up mystery or lyricism or horses in poems, but as so many things are in life, the test results from Boston, of all places, that great center of analysis, are inconclusive.
Inconclusive, though each necropsy showed that the poison was delivered with the aid of a carrot or a sugar cube in a carrot.
I mean, that's such an unforgettably wonderful, surreal moment. It's just like, was it Breton who said, the man who cannot envision a horse galloping upon a tomato is an idiot? And I mean, you can't help but think of that kind of wonderful American inflected surrealism that this poem really reawakens, because I think it was a long strain of American poetry now, I think, subsided. And I just love how Tom Lux in this poem, and actually in lots of his poems, really sort of keeps that alive for us at the expense of some horses in this case.
Yeah, it also, what you were saying makes me think of Plath and Ariel and the incredible lyricism of that Ariel horse. And here, as you say, it's really stripped. The other thing I was thinking of with this is what you said about how it can only be told in a poem. If this were a short story, there would be, you know, much more of a conclusion, it seems to me, mm-hmm. probably.
It would be like fleshed out way too much.
Yeah. I mean, here we're ending, as you said, with that great image of a sugar cube in a carrot and then no reaction from anybody
that
we've seen so far. Exactly. That's it. It almost makes me think of, you know, how you have to end a sonnet on 14 lines if you're doing it correctly. You know, it sort of boxes you in. This is not a sonnet or anywhere near that, but you feel as if it has a certain kind of truncation going on, mm-hmm. and it's effective.
In recent years, we've been hearing a lot about whether or not to build a section of the Keystone Pipeline, which would transport Canadian oil through the United States. It's controversial because the pipeline will be built through sensitive environmental areas in Nebraska.
It's also controversial because much of the oil would come from the tar sands in northern Alberta. The tar sands are full of bitumen, a viscous, almost gelatinous substance that is turned into oil through a process that environmentalists say is causing serious environmental damage.
We're mentioning all this because it's part of the backdrop of Karen Solis' poem in the May issue of Poetry. Karen Solis lives in Toronto, and her poem Bitumen is excerpted from her book, The Road In Is Not the Same Road Out. Part of Bitumen takes place in northern Alberta, but it begins with the great romantic landscape painter J.M.W. Turner.
The poem generated from a concern for the oil sands, but it was a strange situation of having someone describe a landscape as being a way to understand Turner's paintings. And then in the course of looking at Turner's paintings online, I fell down a rabbit hole that, honest to God, led me from Turner to Bertinsky to, you know, the constitution of bitumen and what has been written about it to Jericho and back to Turner. It was really strange, so I thought I would follow it.
And we'll follow her. But it's quite a long poem, so we're going to hear first the opening and then a longer section from the end.
For the opening section, it's helpful to know that the Ocean Ranger was an offshore oil rig that sank off the coast of Newfoundland in 1982, killing all of its 84 crew members. The Piper Alpha was a production platform in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland that exploded in 1988, killing 167 people.
The Sikorsky is a type of helicopter, often used to transport workers to their remote posts.
Bitumen. One might understand Turner, you said. In North Atlantic sky, east-southeast from Newfoundland toward Hibernia. Cloud, darker than cloud, cast doubt upon muttering, pacing water. Even backlit by a devouring glare that whitened its edges, bent the bars. Waters apart from society by choice, their living room the aftermath of accident or crime. When the storm comes, we will see into it. There will be no near and no far. In 65-foot seas for the Ocean Ranger, green turned to black, then white, as molecules changed places in the Jeanne d'Arc basin. The way wood passes into flame, and communication errors into catastrophic failure for the Piper Alpha offshore from Aberdeen. It burned freely. If I don't come home, is my house in order? Big fear travels in the Sikorsky. 12-hour shifts travel with them. The deluge system, aqueous foam. Machinery's one note hammering the heart. Identity compressed with intentions. Drenched, the tired body performs delicately timed, brutal tasks no training adequately represents and which consume the perceivable world. In beds on the drilling platform in suspended disbelief, identified by the unlovely sea's aggression, no sleep aids should a directive come. Underwater welders, deeply unconscious. Survival suits profane in lockers. By dreams of marine flares and inflatables, buoyant smoke, percolating fret, one is weakened. Violence enters the imagination.
It's funny that the poem starts off talking about Turner as a painter in the landscape, because the way for me, at least, to experience the poem, which is pretty complicated, I guess, is to understand it as a series of brushstrokes laid one sort of across and upon the other to build up a very significant kind of texture on the page, so that each line of the poem is a kind of added piece of what turns into a much larger whole. So that when you step back, you kind of have an experience, in this case, of a very vitally complicated landscape that involves communication failures and ecological disaster. It's a very interesting way to look at something that's going on in the news.
Let's skip now to the final stanzas of the poem. The thing to know here is The Raft of the Medusa is a painting by the French romantic artist Théodore Géricault. The Medusa is a French naval frigate that ran aground off the coast of West Africa in 1816.
The Medusa was carrying 400 people, but there was room for only 250 of them in the ship's boats. The rest had to make do with a leaky makeshift raft. The boats were supposed to tow the raft to safety, but it was deliberately turned loose after a few miles. After 13 days of starvation, thirst, death, and cannibalism, only 15 men were still alive when it was rescued by another ship, the Argus.
The painting depicts the raft on the open seas at the dramatic moment the Argus appears on the horizon. Here's the rest of the poem.
We're all downstream now. Action resembles waiting for a decision made on our behalf, then despair after the fact. Despair which, like bitumen itself, applied to render darker tones or an emphatic tenebrism, imparts a velvety, lustrous disposition, but eventually discolors to a black treacle that degrades any pigment it contacts. Details in sections of Raft of the Medusa can no longer be discerned. In 1816, the Medusa's captain, in a spasm of flamboyant incompetence, ran aground on the African coast and, fearing the ire of his constituents, refused to sacrifice the cannons. They turned on each other. 147 low souls herded onto a makeshift raft cut loose from lifeboats of the wealthy and well-connected. The signs were there. Risk-reward coefficient alive in the wind. The locomotive, small tragic towns left for work, where the only thing manufactured is the need for work. Foreshortening and a receding horizon include the viewer in the scene, should the viewer wish to be included in the scene. One can't be sure if the brig, Argus, is racing to the rescue or departing. It hesitates in the distance, in its nimbus of fairer weather, the courage and compassion of a new age on board. Géricault's pyramidical composition, dead and dying in the foreground from which the strong succeed upward toward an emotional peak, an influence for Turner's Disaster at Sea, the vortex structure of the slave ship. All those abandoned, where is thy market now? It's difficult to imagine everyone saved. It's unaffordable. Waves, disproportionate, organized in depth, panic modulating the speaking voice. The situation so harshly primary and not beautiful, when you don't go to visit the seaside, but the seaside visits you, rudely, breaks in through the basement, ascends stairs to your bedroom. You can't think of it generally, then. The constitution of things is accustomed to hiding. Rearrangement will not suit us. Certain low-lying river deltas, island states, coastal regions, floodwaters receding in measures like all we haven't seen the last of, reveal in stagnancies and bloat what's altered, as vernal exhalations of mines and flares are altered, but don't disappear. Still, iceberg season is spectacular this year. worth the trip to photograph an evening ourselves before the abundance when, a flame in light that dissolves what it illuminates, water climbs its own red walls, vermilion in the furnaces.
I think this poem is just such an interesting approach to writing about visual art, or the technical term for that is ekphrasis. One of the things that's so interesting is that it's not just Turner, it's Géricault as well. It's sort of a prism of different paintings that are giving you various historical information to encounter and play off of the contemporary scene, too. I love the notion here that it takes off from Turner but follows the pathway of association and information from Turner to Géricault to this sort of gorgeous ending that we just heard, its own red walls, vermilion in the furnaces. It's really striking.
To me, the way that she's able to connect the two with bitumen, this substance that, as she says in the poem, is not only, you know, the source of our environmental issues right now, but also capable of making, as she says,
despair, which, like bitumen itself, applied to render darker tones or an emphatic tenebrism, imparts a velvety, lustrous disposition, but eventually discolors to a black treacle that degrades any pigment it contacts.
And so the result of that is there are sections of this painting, the Raft of the Medusa, that are no longer visible because of the substance they used to paint it. And the idea that this blackness is both valuable artistically, but also degrading at the same time. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. And I mean, overall, the poem reminds us that art has a responsibility to record the disasters of its time in which it even participates in some ways, and that there are reasons to believe that when people look back on what's been going on, they might turn to the poets to say, what was it like when this was happening? You know, didn't people think about it? Didn't they know what was going on? There are news reports and sort of historical summaries, but it's almost like poets and painters alike can, with images, convey something that has more depth than that and is therefore a vehicle, a better vehicle for the real tragedy of events than a summary, a prose summary in a history book or in contemporary news reports. And so even though it's very beautiful, especially the end that Christina mentioned, you know, water climbs its own red walls, vermilion in the furnaces, very painterly, just a couple of stanzas ahead of that, the poem really describes its own responsibilities as well as its subject matter.
Foreshortening and a receding horizon include the viewer in the scene, should the viewer wish to be included in the scene.
I mean, that's sort of the crux of any experience reading a poem, is how far you know, put yourself into it and go along with it. And in that sense, what's interesting, if you step back from it, is that the complexity of the poem, which I suppose a lot of people will have trouble with, you know, there are people who don't like poems that require you to do the work of sorting and sifting through them. But this posits that as a kind of moral issue that's akin to the other ones the poem raises, because you have to decide. If you want to be included in the scene of the poem, then what you're included in is ecological disaster. And it's a way to have accepting or rejecting political responsibility. In other words, how much do you want to be involved in that? So if you step back from the poem and say, it's got nothing to do with me and I don't relate to it, what you're really doing is saying that this thing that's going on in this geography of the world is also something you can step back from. So I kind of like that the poem sort of pursues its readers, and that it's not just something flat on the page, and it's not just painterly, and it's not just sort of a work of description of a scene. It's description of a dilemma.
One of the ways that it does that is counterbalances that painterly lyricism with phrases like communication errors into catastrophic failure that feel as if they could have been lifted from a news report or something like that. And so I think part of how it's accomplishing this great moral investigation that you were just describing is by letting these various layers of diction interact with one another in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it connects the artwork that's in a museum with what's really happening, which is a great redemption of them. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, she also talks about Caspar David Friedrich's Wanderer.
One might, like Caspar David Friedrich's Wanderer, at a certain remove from principal events, cut a sensitive figure in the presence of the sublime. Except you can smell it down here.
Right.
That's really remarkable.
That kind of echoes the part at the end that I also find really effective, where she says,
"The situation so harshly primary and not beautiful, when you don't go to visit the seaside, but the seaside visits you, rudely, breaks in through the basement, ascends stairs to your bedroom. You can't think of it generally, then."
That gets to what you were saying, Don, about how you might choose to ignore environmental issues, but when it affects you directly, when you have flooding or you have some sort of personal disaster, it's not beautiful like a painting anymore. Mm. It's your own catastrophe.
Yeah. For much of his career, Frank Bidart has been writing poems that are often about very, on the face of it, unpoetic subjects. He's written a monologue of a suicidal anorexic woman and another of a serial killer.
In the May issue, Bidart enters the mind of one of the most ruthless killers in history, Genghis Khan. It's called The Fourth Hour of the Night, and it's a collage of narrative sequences from the life of the founder of the Mongol Empire.
Before he became the great Khan, he was Temujin, the son of a Mongol chieftain who was murdered when Temujin was just a boy. Let's hear the first part of the poem. The wooden wheel is a kind of portable stock to restrain prisoners.
Out of scarcity, being. Because when you were 9, your father was murdered, betrayed. Because the traveler was betrayed by those with whom he had the right to seek refuge, the Tatars. Because the universe then allowed a creature stronger, taller, more ruthless than you to fasten around your neck a thick wooden wheel impossible to throw off. Because at 9, your cunning was not equal to iron-fastened immense wood. Because stripped of what was his from birth, the slave at 10 outwitted the universe, tore the wheel from his neck. Because your neck carries it still. Scarcity is the mother of being.
Let's skip now to the sixth section of the poem and the story of Temujin's friend and future rival, Jamukha.
Even the conqueror of the world is powerless against the dead. The most intricate plan his friend, Jamukha, ever accomplished was to make Temujin execute him. They met as boys. By the frozen waters of the Onon, Temujin gave Jamukha the knuckle bone of a deer. Jamukha gave Temujin the knuckle bone of a deer. They could see their breaths. They mingled breaths. They swore they were Onda brothers. They sharpened arrows, juniper, cypress. When they met again many years later, Temujin's wife, Borte, had been seized by another tribe. Jamukha commanded a whole tribe. He pledged his friend 20,000 men. Temujin also, by this time, was chief, but of many fewer. The two friends and two armies found and freed Borte after 9 months. The Onda celebrated by the waters of the Onon. They were too drunk, too happy. Jamukha pulled a blanket over himself and Temujin. They lay all night under the same blanket. For either to have expressed desire, to have reached, would have been to offer the object of desire power. It could not be done.
The erotically charged relationship and rivalry between Temujin and Jamukha takes up the heart of Bedart's poem. Temujin reluctantly kills Jamukha and then begins the conquest that will ultimately lead to the creation of the largest empire in history. Let's listen to one more section. You'll need to know that the kings of gold are the Chinese emperors.
Only at the age of 39, Temujin at last was master of all Mongolia. The emissaries of the kings of gold had played tribe against tribe all his life to castrate them, to achieve unity, to achieve the empire essential to maintain unity. Half the tribes had to be massacred. The Tatars killed his father, then after subduing them, followed by their unending, involuted betrayals and rebellions, Temujin, without sorrow, exterminated them. Every male standing higher than a wagon axle was killed, the rest enslaved. Extermination is not a question of vengeance. It is a question of safety, of not allowing what happened to happen.
Well, it's an incredibly ambitious project to take on, trying to tell this story that is going to humanize in some ways Genghis Khan and to speak about him in the context of homoeroticism and relationship that sort of a denied relationship that caused so much destruction and so many murders. The poem is lengthy and narratively inclusive, and in a way it has to be able to accomplish what it sets out to do.
Well, one of the things that's always so challenging in a good way about Frank Bedart's work is that you have to try to work out where the voice in the poem is coming from. In other words, from what perspective this material is being brought to bear. In this particular hour of the night, it strikes me that Bedart is doing something Poundian, except that he's kind of redeeming what Pound himself seems not to have been able to do, to take historical moments, make an epic poem out of that, but without the trappings of the epic. The voice that Bedart has come up with for all of this material makes you feel like you're standing on top of the world and you're able to take in a great deal of complicated and even strange information. It's as if he's found a way in this work that he's been doing for so many years now to meet and exceed some of the qualifications Pound was perhaps trying to lay down for the role, the important role of poetry in contemporary culture, in culture that's alive and not just sort of lying flat on a page somewhere.
What's really striking to me in the last passage that we heard, and I think this highlights what you're talking about, Don, about the flexibility of the language that he uses here, how it ends with, extermination is not a question of vengeance, it is a question of safety, of not allowing what happened to happen. That last sentence can mean so many things within the context of this poem. It's not only trying to avoid a sort of repetition of violence, but it also enacts that repetition at the same time that it tries to prevent it. And so the arc that we see in these excerpts is, you know, from Genghis Khan as a child being enslaved and constricted by this wheel around his neck. And we hear at the end of that section, because your neck carries it still. So that constraint is not something that he's left behind, even though physically that wheel is no longer around his neck.
Mm-hmm. Towards the end of this poem, towards the end of the fourth hour of the night, there are italicized lines that say,
imagination clings to apotheosis. Those who inherit the powerful dead imagine them and cling.
When you see Frank Bidart read his work, you can get a sense of this, how gestural all this is, which makes it a performance as well as a written poem for the page, and that you're allowed to participate in that experience and enjoy it as a performance. It's theatrical, and it nods, I think, to poetry's roots in performance, in theater, in tragedy, and in all of the sort of things that poets with great ambitions have always done. It's a kind of eerie pleasure to just enjoy it for its own sake, you know, rather than to overthink it, to follow the characters and the incidents and have a sort of a general familiarity with them and then let the poem fill that in for you. It's gratifying.
Too often now he woke with his mouth gasping above water, the great wooden wheel around his neck, now buoy, now too heavy to lift.
Well, we have to say goodbye to Christina now. Thank you so much again, as always.
Thank you, Don, and thank you, Lindsay.
You can read all of Frank Bidart's poem and everything else you heard on the program in the May 2015 issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
You can also listen to all of The Fourth Hour of the Night on our website. Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scheer. Thanks for listening.